done. Trying to find where I belong. Father sky awakens me. Feel the rays that make me strong. I wanna see you.
Welcome to Talkin' Music. I'm Allie Lightfoot. That was the band Seahawson with their song Shine off their 2018 release Fight Like a Woman. The Flagstaff, Arizona-based siblings Clayson Benally and Janita Benally make up the band Seahawson. They were in Paonia this month to play at the Blue Sage Center for the Arts, and I spoke to them before their show. Seahawson is a Navajo word that means hope and assurance. That's sort of the basis for your new sound. First of all, I was wondering, you know, if hope and assurance is something you're focusing on now, what gives you hope these days?
Well, Seahawson in our language, and, you know, it depends on what part of the Diné Nation that you go to. Some people say Seahawson, Seahawson, Seahawson. You get it?
Yeah.
But from our region, we say Seahawson. And it's really this core philosophy of being hopeful, of having assurance that things are going to be good, that things are going to work out. And something that you practice daily is to have Seahawson, to be with Seahawson. And so, you know, where I'm finding my hope is with the youth. I am astounded by how amazing the youth are, that how far focused they are into the future, understanding how their decisions today are impacting their future. I mean, there's so many movements that are youth-led. Like you see Red for Ed, you know, you see even in Standing Rock, that was a youth-led movement. We see that all of these indigenous movements are really youth-led, but with the backbone of our elders. So that's where I'm finding hope. I know that, you know, there are so many things going wrong right now in terms of human rights justice, in terms of environmental justice. And I think that we have to find hope within each other. We can't ever let go of that silver lining, knowing that there's going to be a beautiful rainbow after a dark storm.
When we think of the idea of hope, sometimes, you know, for me, we've played in a group called Black Fire going back maybe 25 years ago. We were in Houston, Texas, and you know, we were performing in the detention facility, and we had a new song that we had just written, and it just shared it with these kids, and it was a song that was kind of hopeful. And you know, we got to see their conditions where they just had like mats, and you know, it was a hard
in
concrete
cement.
Floor.
It was an 11-year-old girl who named the song called Downfall.
For her, it was, you know, talking about the idea of hope was when you're at the bottom, when you can't go any further down, you can only look up. And that was such a powerful thing that resonated with me. You know, even to this day, still kind of think about that idea. And resilience for our people is something that has always been, you know, a cornerstone of. There was never an idea of giving up. There was never an idea of suicide within our people. Today, now there's epidemics worldwide, and we see so many people giving in to challenges that sometimes, you know, we can't see the other side, that, oh, this challenge is going to make you stronger and healthier. You're going to come out even more beautiful and radiant, but you just have to work through this because that's what these challenges are for. They're for training and enduring and giving us strength. So that's part of that lesson too.
Just talking about resilience and thinking about these separations that are happening on the border right now. And Indigenous children across the country were forcibly separated from their families and sent to Indian schools. And they were like boarding schools that children were required to go to where they were supposed to assimilate. And so this was happening for many years. I didn't realize it, but it was happening from the late 1800s through the 70s, right? And they were stripped of their language. They were stripped of their culture going to these schools. There were often not very good things happening in a lot of these schools, like abuse and things like that. What do you think the repercussions of this kind of thing are? I mean, I know that's a huge question, but when you're looking at this thing that's happening on the border and you're talking about the topic of resilience, what have you witnessed in your communities from people that experienced that separation?
Well, we see that the effects of that every single day. Because you see now that parents who were children that were sent to boarding schools were raised with abuse. They were raised with cruelty. They were raised not understanding their own personal value or the value of another life. And so I think that we see that now in the way that the generations have parented. And so I think now there's this turnaround that's happening where people are saying we need to go back to our traditional values of parenting because what we were taught in the boarding schools was not right. It's hurting our families. It's hurting our future generations. And so, you know, there's that trauma that one has to work through still. I think my partner was raised in a boarding school and he's still trying to figure out how to be a good parent. And I think that it takes a lot, you know, it takes a lifetime of unlearning because those are your foundational experiences that, you know, that you're learning from. And, you know, and these poor children, you know, on the borders that, you know, and it's happening with refugees all throughout the world as well, with children whose parents are trying to find a safe place for them. And so it's heartbreaking. And I think that, you know, we're seeing something in this time right now that a lot of us read in schools when we were reading the Diary of Anne Frank. And we thought, what would we do? How could this have happened? And here we are today. And what is it that we are going to do?
Our father, Jones Benali, he's a world-renowned hoop dancer and is close to the age of 90, but he's traveling with us, an incredible wisdom keeper. He just has all the knowledge because he didn't go into the boarding school. He was hit out by his mother every time, you know, they'd come to kidnap the kids. She would hide him, and he didn't go until he was about maybe 19 or 20. So when he did go to the school, he had learned ceremonies and traditional dances and a lot of, you know, basically the same as if you were trying to obtain a master's degree, you know, going through your doctorate and helping people, working on delivering babies, all of that. You know, that's what he learned. So he goes to the boarding school, and then they recognize that he, you know, had this ability. And rather than trying to strip that from him, they actually started doing like American goods promotions. And they would, the State Department would send the kids from Sherman, which was in California. He was taken from Black Mesa, kind of the heart of the Navajo Nation, all the way to Sherman Indian Institute out by Riverside, California. And then at that time, you know, it's like usually cut your hair, beat you when you spoke your language. But for my dad, you know, he was recognized for being a cultural ambassador, essentially. Got to go to England, meet the Queen, go all over the world and travel, essentially, even with the Wild West show, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. So we grew up kind of, you know, in a weird, unique space where we would start sharing our traditional culture, teaching, you know, the rest of the world that, hey, we're still here as indigenous people, and we dance, we'd share our songs and teach people that this is what the meaning and the purpose is, and this is something beautiful that's worth keeping. But one thing that we have to remember today is that the people that are south of us, you know, we think of South America, Central America, that's the Americas. You know, these are brothers and sisters as indigenous people. We are Diné. That word means the people. And we know that our clan system, which is beautiful and unique, and that's kind of your identity. You always acknowledge and let people know who you are. Like, we come from the Bitterwater clan on our father's side, and our mother is Russian-Polish. But in that way, when we recognize where we come from, our roots and our identity, we know that we are connected. We're brothers and sisters, you know, all throughout this world. You know, when you think of what it, for somebody to even say that somebody's an illegal immigrant or an alien, you know, that doesn't resonate with us as indigenous people, because we know that these borders are fictitious, these are man-made lines, and that this earth is our home, and no person is illegal upon this home of ours. So it's kind of a hard thing to fathom that somebody would say, no, you're illegal, you can't come into this home that, you know, especially when you think of the founding principles of America, which was based on, you know, freedom of religion and, you know, escaping persecution and coming here for a better life. You know, that's always kind of been the guiding light of hope that people have looked to. So for this country to turn their back and separate families and to destroy these children's lives, you know, before they've even begun, that's an atrocity that we're going to see the repercussions of. You know, I know I'm a byproduct of the assimilation projects that the United States government has done, and I don't speak my language fluently. You know, we see a loss of culture, and we see the impact socially, you know, from alcoholism, drug abuse, higher suicide rates, you know, you name it, you know, all those isms that we see or statistics, you know, that's something that you see impacting us on the Navajo Reservation or other communities that are, you know, have gone through similar types of trauma.
And if you're just joining us, I'm here with Clayson and Janita Benali. They make up the band Seahassin. Janita, you met with Michelle Obama, is that right?
I did have the incredible opportunity to be invited to the White House and meet Michelle Obama.
And I read that you were sort of surprised that they invited you because you had sued the federal government. But you were still invited to the White House. First of all, why did you sue the federal government? And then also, how did you end up at the White House?
Well, my mother, my brother, and myself and a group of people all sued the federal government in order to protect endocrine systems, especially children, from reclaimed wastewater and the endocrine disruptors that are in reclaimed wastewater. And we wanted to protect them from it being sprayed on the side of a holy mountain called the Holy San Francisco Peaks. And basically, there's a small for-profit ski resort that exists on this mountain that is holy to over 13 different tribal nations and culturally significant to 22 nations. But it's also the top of our watershed, not only for us in Flagstaff, but also for the Havasupai Nation and for other surrounding nations as well. And so putting reclaimed wastewater with known endocrine disruptors onto the top of a watershed and allowing for people to ski on it and to have snow play without telling them about the risks of ingestion. Because I'm a snowboarder and I've face planted in the snow before. I've gotten a mouthful of snow. And can you imagine, though, that this is snow made out of reclaimed wastewater? Everything that you flush down your toilet, everything that goes in through the hospital sewage systems, down in. And the thing about it is that endocrine disruptors aren't even tested for. It's not even controlled by the EPA. And so we don't know the extent of the damage that will happen to these young endocrine systems that are growing. What we do know is that it has feminized fish, and it has also created a quicker maturation rate for frogs. And so for us, you know, we know as Diné people that the animals are always the first ones to be impacted. And so when we're looking at their at how they've been impacted, then we know that we will be impacted. It's not a question of if it will happen. It's only a question of when.
Mm-hmm. Is that a common practice for them to use wastewater on ski resort?
This was a precedent, and the lawsuit that we had unfortunately failed. We lost, and the ski resort tried to sue us and take us for all we had. It was a long battle, and to this day, you know, you think of what, you know, like ski resorts mostly throughout even Colorado, you know, most of them are in public lands, and that ski is a recreation, but it's you think of the Forest Service, BLM, and the way that they're managed, and that there's kind of a fine line, you know, between protecting and then exploiting. So from, you know, our community of not wanting to see our, you know, the top of our watershed polluted in that fashion, and to have this entity, this governmental organization just pushing that and promoting that for a ski industry, was kind of unusual, you know, especially when you have like senators like John McCain, you know, holding up Obama appointees until there was reclaimed wastewater snow made. There was a lot of politics that were in play, and a lot of it was because there was a court case prior to ours, which, you know, this mountain has been a precedent-setting mountain. It was the first to kind of test the Indian Religious Freedom Act, RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and in all those cases, they failed, but you know, there were listening sessions that were created. Obama actually started setting up, you know, monthly meetings to listen to tribes, and sacred sites is such a huge issue and topic for us as indigenous people, because, you know, you look at your homeland here, you know, the mountains, the places, the springs that surround you, all of these places had names and significance to the tribes that were here, you know, where are they today? Where is that information? Where is that story? You know, it's such an important part of where you live. It doesn't matter where you live in the United States or in the world. You know, there's places that are sacred. So when you manage sacred sites and you have public lands, you know, how to balance that? There's no way for people to quantify what is sacred. When somebody says something is sacred, how do you put a price tag on that? there's a case between the Navajo Nation and the federal governments as well. And they basically said, well, as indigenous people, you have no religious freedom. You know, your what was their statement was that your spirituality is subjective.
It's a subjective experience. Mm.
So that's what was the courts, and it was reaffirmed by the Supreme Court as well, that as indigenous people, essentially we don't have religious freedom because our religion, our spirituality is only viewed as a subjective belief.
Wow.
It was incredibly difficult because we lost that case. And it seemed that every time Clayson and I spoke out about reclaimed wastewater and the dangers of reclaimed wastewater, we ended up getting sued. And it was really this tactic that the ski resort used to shut our voices up, to silence us. And so when I was invited to the White House, I was like, don't you know that I sued you? There was an award that is given to museums and libraries for their community involvement engagement that happens every year. One of our Arizona representatives had nominated the Museum of Northern Arizona to get this award for museums and libraries, and it's one of the highest awards that you can get in the nation. And so the museum had asked me as a community member, they said, we were nominated, but we need a community member to do the interview to get us this award. And so there were over 500 museums and libraries that had been nominated. And I had spoken about the Museum of Northern Arizona's important role in being a safe space, being a space that is really has been a sanctuary for so many tribes around there. You know, Flagstaff is a border town to so many different Native nations, which means, unfortunately, that there's a lot of racism that exists. There's a lot of people who really enjoy our arts and crafts, but they don't want to see the Native Americans. And they'd rather just make a profit off of us. And so, basically, I spoke to the fact that the Museum of Northern Arizona has always been a sanctuary. It's always been that sacred space where tribes were honored and respected, and where tribes knew that, you know, that they could come and they could meet within the vicinity of the Holy San Francisco Peaks, within Flagstaff. And so that's kind of what I spoke to. And somehow what I said resonated. The award was given to the Museum of Northern Arizona, and there were only 5 museums and libraries that were given this award. And so it was a pretty incredible experience. I had the opportunity to talk with Michelle Obama about the importance of youth empowerment and really about investing. You know, the fact is that if we don't invest in our youth, then we have no future. If we don't nurture our youth, if we don't encourage our youth, then they won't be empowered or bold enough to understand that they are the world of possibility.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your transition from being Blackfire to Seahassin. Why did you, how did the band evolve? I guess that's the best way to ask the question.
So there's a funny connection here. We have a dear friend that lives here that invited us and helped kind of organize the event tonight, Charlie Jankiewicz. And he gave us a cassette tape way back when we were living in the Grand Canyon in the early 80s. And it had the Bad Brains, Sex Pistols, the Ramones. That was part of the key right there, is that the Ramones eventually became part of our family. They took us in, and they were like, you know, Uncle Joey. CJ was like our brother. Didn't really connect so much with the rest of the band, you know. But it was amazing to just have that guidance and to have punk rock. You know, the godfathers of punk rock, you know, they labeled us Fireball Punk Rock back when we had our group Blackfire. And for us, it was about energy. You know, the idea of the Ramones was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, really hard driving, fast, 3-minute songs. And that was, you know, they produced our first album and really gave us guidance. And now I think we're at a stage in our life, you know, we're being parents, you know, I've got 2 beautiful daughters, and, you know, wanting to give them something, you know, the anger and the frustration that comes along with punk, you know, it's like, it's not, maybe it's maturing or something growing up, but wanting to give them something more and give them energy and music that has that hope. That's part of my goal. Make them dance, make them move, mm. make them feel inspired. Not just my daughters, but, you know, being a parent, you start to look at kids and see them kind of all as your children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the Ramones played a big role in kind of shaping us. But the transition from Blackfire to Seehausen, that was also part of the court case. You know, the fact that, like, my entire life, I've wanted to be an attorney. It's kind of funny that I've been in a punk rock band because I was like, I love law. But most of all, I love justice. And so when we sued the federal government, I thought, we have a really great case. And by all accounts of what is just, like, we should win this case. And when our court case was not even listened to on its true merits, and they just kept trying to find ways to throw out our case, I realized that there was no justice in the justice system. And it infuriated me and it depressed me more than anything, because the one thing that I always wanted to be, I realized wasn't real. And not only that, but there was a rash of youth suicides that had happened, and the youngest child was like 9 years old. And I thought, oh my gosh, how is it that a young person in this amazing world of possibility and hope loses hope? And so I decided, I can't make music that's angry anymore. Like, most of all, like, my heart is calling me to make music that inspires and empowers people to make positive change in their communities, to make a more just world where we are respected, you know, where all people are respected, and that we all strive towards a more hopeful and respectful and just community. And that was really the transition for me. It was actually going and hitting that rock bottom, you know, like the 11-year-old in the Texas juvenile detention facility had said, hitting that rock bottom and realizing what comes after anger. Like, I've been angry for so much of my life. What comes next? And that's when I realized that hope has to come next, because that otherwise it's just a negative spiral. And I don't want to be a negative spiral. I want to be part of what is positive and beautiful in this world and do my part to uplift others to be at their greatest potential.
Well, thank you very much for dropping by KBNF. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. And I've been here with Seehausen.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, it's been such a deep, deep talk. Bearing my soul.
We can, we will, we are strong together. We can, we will, we are strong together. We can, we will, we are strong together. It wasn't always perfect. Nothing ever is. Seems like it's been forever since it all began. My hand extends for yours. Meet halfway, a dangerous kind of silence. We shall overcome. We can, we will, we are strong together. We can, we will, we are strong together.
We are. together.